Wisconsin is the 2019 Republican State Convention in Oshkosh, interviewing U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Senator, thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Good morning.
The term that I hear in Washington is constitutional crisis. Let's start there. Are we in a constitutional crisis, sir?
No. This is the way our Constitution was meant to work.
Yes, sir.
Or not work, you know, however you want to say it. No, we're not in a constitutional crisis, not by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, when the president invokes such a broad executive privilege over both the testimony and over the documents, is he overexerting that privilege, Senator?
I would say that we do need to be very careful about busting executive privilege. You know, the job of a president is, it's enormous. I don't know why anybody would want to be president, quite honestly. What presidents definitely needed, they need advisors that can speak freely. And when you start delving into that realm and you start really defiling the process of executive privilege, you're going to hamper any president, I don't care which party that president's from getting very unvarnished, very truthful, very honest, blunt advice from the people that he's going to rely on to make really tough decisions.
The Mueller report has been out a few weeks now, so elected officials like you have had a few weeks to digest it. Case closed, obviously no collusion, but the obstruction issue, the Democrats in the U.S. House continue to make much about that. Your reflections a few weeks after.
First of all, we should all be very grateful that there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And truthfully, the only collusion I could see from one campaign to a potential foreign power might be with Hillary Clinton, the Simpson dossier, the Steele dossier, run by Glenn Simpson's Fusion GPS. So it's good that we didn't have that type of collusion. In terms of obstruction of justice, Attorney General Barr had to make the tough call. It's the call that Special Counsel Mueller should have made in terms of whether there's any kind of prosecutorial or indictable type of offense. He didn't make it. Attorney General did. I'm happy to agree with Attorney General Barr.
You think Mr. Mueller should testify before the Congress?
I have no problem with it, but I'm not sure what else he'd say. He laid out all the findings in excruciating detail. And by the way, for people like Jerry Nadler who have access to the full unredacted report, I don't know why they haven't gone down to take a look at it. If they really want the information, they're just trying to make a political point.
If you were on a committee and Mr. Mueller was testifying before it, any specific questions you would ask him, Senator?
No, I would like to know, when did you conclude that there was no conclusion?
Okay.
Collusion.
Okay.
I'd like to know that. I was not supportive of the appointment of a special counsel. I didn't think that in terms of the mandate that the special counsel had that Robert Mueller was the right person, because I thought the special counsel should have taken a look at the entire process. You know, what was the predicate for the investigation? Was there wrongdoing on the part of anybody in the FBI, Department of Justice, intelligence community? He just had conflicts of interest having run the FBI for the 12 years prior to that. So, you know, and as a result, we've gone through this 18, 19-month process, and we're now no closer really to finding out exactly what happened inside the FBI. Now, what we do know is there's definitely corruption. Andrew McCabe, the Inspector General, showed that he lied to his own investigators. George Papadopoulos spent, I think, 10 days in Wisconsin jail for lying to the FBI. So the acting director ought to know better. So at that point, I think he was deputy director. We'll see what happens with him in terms of prosecution. But you know, other people, like people struck, Lisa Page, demoted, either left or fired. James Baker, James Comey, fired. There was, from my standpoint, definite corruption in the FBI, and that needs to all be revealed. And the questions I have, too, based on those Peter Strzok, Lisa Page texts, where they're referring to the sisters leaking like mad, scorned, worried, political, they're going to overdrive. And then later on, he's talking about the agencies being targeted for some of these leaks. We need to take a look at that as well. What was being leaked? For what purpose?
So you welcomed the decision by Attorney General Barr last week to name a special prosecutor to look into the circumstances under which the FBI may have spied on the campaign?
He hasn't named a special prosecutor. What he's done, he's just named somebody within the Justice Department, which is the appropriate thing to take a look at this. I do support that, but one of the things I'm trying to make, you know, in discussions and working with the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's office is I want to make sure that Congress has access to the information as well. The American people need to know exactly what happened. Even if the activity, the wrongdoing, doesn't rise to a prosecutable or indictable crime, These are political matters, and the American public need to know if the agencies were misused for political purposes, and that's what Congress's role is. That's our oversight role, and I don't want our ability to do oversight hampered by a criminal investigation.
After 8 years in the Senate,
the term deep state, is there a deep state, sir?
Well, from my standpoint, you certainly have people within these agencies that are not... That are biased. I mean, we saw that clearly with Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. I have suspicions in other agencies as well that have a political agenda. They do not necessarily cooperate, particularly with a conservative president. So call it what you will. These agencies are kind of a power unto themselves, and they are very difficult to get control of, particularly by a Republican or conservative president. So I'm concerned about that.
Final question on this issue. How do you see the impasse between the U.S. House leaders, Nadler and Pelosi, and the president and the White House playing out? Contempt and subpoenas. How does this all end, sir?
It's right now it's a big old political game. That's really all it is, which is what I warned voters in, you know, prior to the 2018 election, is if you give the control of the House of Representatives to the Democrats, we're not going to be talking about passing bills and good governance and working at growing our economy for greater prosperity for the American public. We're going to be talking about investigations, talk of impeachment, and that's where we're at right now. These things go through legal process. They'll end in the same kind of impasse that when the House under Republican control held Eric Holder into contempt after 255 days of frustration. I think Jerry Nadler is holding Attorney General Barr into contempt after, 19 days? It's pretty absurd.
Okay, now let's turn to immigration. You went to the border. The president going again next week. Thank you. The president announced a merit-based plan, and you handed out today these cups. Explain the significance of these cups, sir.
Well, this is our latest chart, and I've been updating it on a monthly basis. It's really describing in one graphic the problem we're experiencing. It's no longer Mexican single males coming here for economic purposes. Now it's really primarily people from Central America traveling as families or unaccompanied children, completely exploiting our laws of asylum. And it's being exploited by the traffickers. And one thing people need to understand is our loopholes, our broken legal immigration system, our very lax asylum standards are sustaining a very evil business model. These human traffickers are probably putting about $400 million per month into their pocket, causing folks from Central America to mortgage the house, pay a year's worth of salary, and go on a very dangerous journey, being abused not only along the journey, but potentially when they get into the United States, ongoing involuntary servitude would be one of the results as well. So this has exploded. In 2014, President Obama declared a humanitarian crisis when 120,000 people came across our border illegally, either as an unaccompanied child or a family unit. In the first 7 months of this year, we're over 300,000. Apprehensions been over 100,000 the last 2 months. It's completely overwhelmed our system because we have no ability to detain. And so what's happening, and this is what's being exploited, is we basically don't even apprehend them. They turn themselves in. They're looking for Border Patrol. Border Patrol handles them with as great humanity as possible, but they basically process them, turn them over to ICE. ICE processes them, turns them over to a non-government organization like a church. They've contact relatives in the United States. They buy them a bus ticket or plane ticket, and they are gone. Most of them never be heard of again. They're living in the shadows. And if you're concerned about immigration depressing American wages, you need to be concerned about illegal immigration, because it's those individuals that can be abused by unscrupulous employers. That's what depresses American wages, not a legal system.
You return, or you're going back to the border next week. You're going to ask what additional questions or what additional changes will you be seeking when you go back, sir?
Well, when I went a couple weeks ago, I was El Paso pretty much by myself, because I want to see that process that I just described to you. People turn themselves in, being processed, and within 6-7 days, home free into America, here to stay for, you know, probably forever, permanently. So now I'm taking members of my committee down to McAllen, which is the main point. In El Paso, it's about an 11-mile stretch, about 700 people per day is what the average is. 700 people per day. 28 Border Patrol agents should be on the border. They're only leaving about 2 or 3 to patrol the border. The rest are processing 700 people a day. In McAllen, it's probably double that figure, if not more. So it's a huge crisis. So we're really there to show my Republican-Democrat colleagues on the committee exactly what that chart looks like in human terms, so we can actually engage in the first step in solving a problem, which is admitting you have one, defining it properly, which is, again, it's not Mexican economic migrants, it's children and people coming as family units, exploiting our laws so we can take the first step in fixing it.
Do you support the merit-based plan that the president announced, I believe, just yesterday, sir?
Now, absolutely. If you take a look at other countries like Australia, like Canada, they grant legal permanent residency. 60% of those people have jobs. And they also have sponsorships so that those individuals that come into their country are granted residency aren't a burden on society. In America, we grant about 1.1 million people per year legal permanent residency, less than 10. You know, people say it's about 12%, but that includes the family member of somebody coming in actually getting a job. Mm-hmm. So it's no more than 12%, probably less than 10% of people coming in here of that 1.1 million with a job, you know, knowing that they will sustain themselves through work, you know, into areas of our economy that need the employees. The rest is primarily family unification, refugee asylees. And it's completely out of control, and it's a crazy system.
Did the president, by announcing a policy, was there any progress made when Speaker Pelosi said it's not addressing DACA?
I think DACA will be addressed because everybody I know on the Republican side also wants to deal with the Dreamers. Okay. But we also, when we do that, we want to marry that with a solution to some of these problems of our broken legal immigration system. Turn it more to a merit base, address the families and kids coming in here on an out-of-control basis. Democrats never want to solve that problem. They only want to deal with Dreamers. Republicans want to do it all.
Okay. Another issue that you spent a lot of effort on. Are you convinced that foreign actors, including the Russians, have less capability to influence our 2020 elections based on what you've learned?
Because we're fully aware of it. By the way, I was fully aware of it even before then. I'm chairman of the European Subcommittee on Foreign Relations.
Yes.
So we were holding hearings a few years before the 2016 election on Russian interference into, for example, Montenegro, where they tried to attempted a coup. Mm-hmm. All their disinformation, all their propaganda throughout Eastern Europe. So, you know, Russia's always been, you know, fooling around with our politics. So it shouldn't surprise us. We just become more aware now of exactly the methods they use, using social media. But, you know, truthfully, social media companies are trying to do everything they can. They're shutting down these sites. If you shut down a site that's been operating for 2 or 3 years and developing readership, you shut it down, all that effort goes away. And so we're policing it better. DHS is fully aware of it. We have now certified people in states, I think all 50 states, to be able to get classified material for threat signatures. You know, if you're trying to hack into the voter files, which I think is the greatest threat.
Which they did in one precinct in Florida.
In Florida in 2016.
Yes.
Nothing that we know of in 2018, because DHS under Obama and under Trump have been on the case, working with states. People are aware of it. I've always said, cyber attacks, cyber security is a huge issue. It's not going away. The folks on offense are always going to stay ahead of us, but our first line of defense, our most effective line of defense, is just awareness. I mean, the fact that we've had all these high publicized attacks on Target and Sony and across the board, now corporations are fully aware of it. Election officials are fully aware of it. So that's the first step, and it's a very important step of preventing any kind of harmful attacks.
So we have made major progress to prevent foreign actors, anybody from trying to influence the 2020 election.
Yes, from a standpoint of vote tallies are almost impossible. Those voting machines during the elections are not hooked up to the internet. Most don't even have Wi-Fi connections.
Yes.
The next level would be accessing the voter files, but we have backups. So, I mean, we'd find out they could really mess up the election, but shouldn't affect the vote tally. The one that, again, continues to vex us is the use of social media. And it's very difficult to police, but because we are aware of it, we are shutting down sites, and it's going to make any attempt far less effective. You know, Steve, we spend billions a year, you know, legally trying to affect elections. I'm not sure how effective all that spending is. It's one of the things we're going to be talking about here at the state convention. So, you know, people do need to calm down. I don't want to blow this out of proportion. We need to be concerned about it. We need to be aware. But I think we are, and that's our first line of defense.
Another issue you've worked on extensively is health care. Where do we stand now that the Trump administration says we're not going to offer a specific plan until after the next presidential election? Is the next thing to happen a potential court ruling of the Federal Court of Appeals on the Texas lawsuit eventually going to the Supreme Court? Can you update us on health care?
Again, I'm not exactly sure where that court case is going to go. From my standpoint, even during our attempt in 2017 to repeal and replace, you know, I was always, you know, my counsel inside the conferences, you know, we should be talking about is, you know, identifying and repairing the damage done, the specific damage done by Obamacare, primarily in the individual market because of the faulty design, asking a very small percentage of the American public to bear the full cost burden of covering people with pre-existing conditions. By the way, we are all going to make sure that people are covered with pre-existing conditions. That was the big lie of 2018. Nobody's going to do away with that, okay? But we do need to address the faulty architecture of Obamacare. So I was always saying repair the damage done and transition to a system that works. So, you know, we failed in that attempt. You know, I really regret that, but we failed. Now what I think the president's more than willing to do is let's take a look at individual improvements. The Democrats are always saying, mend it, don't end it. I'm happy to work with them on that. Let's take a look at drug pricing. There's been some restraints there, but there are a lot of abuses, patent abuse, the lack of price transparency. I'm actually hosting a meeting in next week with folks from Mylan Labs to brief senators. Here's how screwed up our whole pricing mechanism is, you know, with Medicaid, with Medicare, with the pharmacy benefit managers. I mean, we need to take a look at how messed up the pricing system is, the lack of transparency. So there's specific things that I think we can fix, that we can mend, make it a better system, and that's certainly my counsel. When the president's saying delay it till after the election, I think he's talking about a full replacement. I don't see Democrats cooperating with Republicans. I don't think Mitch McConnell thinks that could happen. We couldn't get it done, quite honestly, when we had Republicans with the control of the House and a majority in the Senate. So I think people are just being realistic in terms of a complete replacement for Obamacare, but there's certainly things we can do to improve the current system and repair some of the damage done by the faulty architecture of Obamacare.
Foreign relations. 2 days ago, the president was asked, are we going to go to war with Iran? And his response, I hope not. Did you find that a chilling response? Do you see a real potential that we could be at war with Iran?
No, I think most people that are listening to the president realizes within his administration he is the most reluctant. And so if you don't want to engage Iran, you ought to be pretty comfortable by the fact that President Trump does not want to do that.
Are you concerned about the advisors around him?
I'm concerned about Iran's behavior. And I think we have every reason to be concerned. I've gone down, I've read the intelligence briefing. Without getting into the specifics, I think what the administration is doing is prudent, because what they're trying to do is show a display of force to deter activity by Iran. And again, you're not going to deter all activity by Iran. I mean, their IEDs killed at least 1,000, if not 2,000 Americans in the Iraq war. They are the ones that are fomenting the rebellion and the tragic war in Yemen. They obviously are dealing in Syria. They attempted to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C. So they are the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. The Iranian nuclear deal was an awful deal, funneled over $100 billion into that evil regime, and that's what this president is having to deal with. So, again, I think it's very prudent. Show us strength. Say, do not do anything further, Iran. Do not attack ships in the Hormuz Straits. So, again, I think it's a very prudent action, and I think Americans should be comforted by the fact that President Trump does not want to engage us in war, but if we're attacked, if our allies are attacked, Iran will pay a very heavy price. They need to understand that.
Let's talk about North Korea. How concerned are you that North Korea continues to test fire some missiles, sir? How big a threat is that to America?
Well, North Korea is a real problem. It's been an ongoing problem and a very vexing problem for multiple administrations. It is important that their testing not proceed any further. I'm not exactly sure what those missiles were. It seems like they're shorter. They weren't the ICBMs that we're really concerned about in terms of them getting greater and greater knowledge.
They seem to have been shorter range.
So just the fact that we've gotten some hostages returned, the remains of U.S. soldiers returned, the fact that we've been able to halt testing, has been an achievement, not anywhere near as far as we want to achieve, mm-hmm. but the dialogue is important. The fact that they aren't testing the significant systems is still a pretty positive sign. So, again, what other administrations have done in the past didn't work. This administration is obviously taking an unorthodox approach. There's been some success. We have a long way to go.
Third international hotspot is Venezuela. Have you followed that closely? Are we on the verge of toppling that?
It was very unfortunate. We've heard some assessments of what went wrong with when Juan Guaido really tried to assert and really replace Maduro. It sounds like there were people close to Maduro in the military that either didn't get a good enough deal and kind of backtracked on the agreement, or whether maybe they tried to engage in that takeover a day or two too soon. It was very unfortunate that that didn't work. But we will maintain pressure on Maduro regime, put pressure on Russia to not get further involved and hopefully remove their involvement. The main bad actor here is Cuba. And again, I would argue the Obama administration's policy of detente, cooling our relationship with Cuba, was very, very ill-founded because they weren't changing their behavior, just emboldened them. And it's really Cuba's behavior that has really corrupted Venezuela and supported first Chavez and now Maduro in basically starving his people and destroying their economy. It's just a tragedy. It's a human tragedy.
Is it wise for the United States to support Juan Guaido, or should we be supporting some other oppositions?
No, Juan Guaido is the duly elected head of their governing body, their assembly, and so he is the legitimate authority in Venezuela. Maduro is just not giving up power because he still controls the military. But I think we have 50 different nations that have followed our leadership, yes, and basically agreed that Juan Guaido is the legitimate elected president of Venezuela. Maduro just needs to get the message, and hopefully with more and more pressure, that'll happen sooner rather than later.
Let's talk farm politics. The president has said that eventually farmers will be okay in the wake of these tariffs and other issues. Should Wisconsin farmers be satisfied with that? Because as you're well aware, as they tell you, they're hurting right now, sir.
They are, and so are manufacturing interests in Wisconsin. So no, we are. In one state in particular that is really feeling the short-term pain here, what has amazed me, talking to both manufacturers and farmers, is even though they're feeling the pain, one of the last comments they'll make to me is, but we really support what the president's trying to do. We have been abused by China's cheating for literally decades now, and we do need China to start behaving. They have to stop stealing our intellectual property through cyber theft, through espionage, through the forced technology transfers. They have to follow the WTO rules, which they don't, which is why so many cases go against them. And so previous administrations have tried to bring them into compliance without success. This apparently is what is required to bring them into compliance with the world trading regime. It's unfortunate, but it's really China's fault.
So you support the president's ratcheting up tariffs, both the percentage of the tariffs and the items subject to tariffs?
Yeah, I support the president's goal. I'm hoping that his negotiating strategy is correct. The sooner we can do a deal, the better. It's very unfortunate that President Xi backtracked from where they were, because what good is an agreement if it's not enforceable, if they don't change their laws? And it was really at that enforcement stage in the negotiation where they got cold feet. Very unfortunate.
As the top elected Republican in Wisconsin, you ordered a financial autopsy on the state party. What did you learn from that autopsy that concerned you?
Well, I'm not in a position to order anything, so I just stepped up and led. And really, it was a post-election assessment.
Yes.
What went right, what went wrong, and we do need to understand that although we lost every statewide race, we did a pretty good job below that top of the ballot. Mm-hmm. And so we want to make sure we embrace that. It was really more a question of, what went right, what went wrong. Part of it was taking a look at the finances. From my standpoint, nothing we found surprised me. I'm not a big fan of some of the types of consultants in these election campaigns, being a business guy. But it's very manageable. It is true that it would have been political malpractice to leave millions in the coffers of the RPW in a close election. And, to the extent that we are have a small amount of debt, it's all pretty manageable. So I don't want to blow anything out of proportion at all. I'm far more interested in what we need to do, lessons learned in terms of campaigns run by consultants, primarily focusing on ads.
Yeah.
Put all their effort to ads, which, by the way, you need ads. You need good ones.
Right.
But you also have to completely focus on the grassroots. So that's really the theme of today is, and of this convention.
So
is, okay, we've looked at that. We've come to agreement. It was almost unanimous in terms of what went wrong, what we think we need to do. And so now it's focusing on the future. And how do you set up a state party whose primary focus and function is to support the county parties? And the county parties have to have very specific responsibilities, and they have to do them well. So as a business guy, I look at this more as a corporate model, where the RPW is the headquarters, and we have 72 divisions. Let's call them 72 franchises. They all have to be first class. They have to be operating efficiently and effectively.
Okay. you have talked about, you came from the private sector. That was your whole career. You've now been in public service for 8 years, which is more satisfying?
Well, obviously, it's far less frustrating in the private sector. There are all kinds of frustration. Business is hard. You win, you lose, and that can be unbelievably frustrating and, quite honestly, potentially financially ruining. So there are a lot of risks in the private sector, but at least you can get things accomplished a lot easier, okay, whether you do it right or do it wrong, at least you're moving forward.
More frustrations in public service?
Way more frustrations my current position. But I tell you what, it's not boring, and it's incredibly important. So that's certainly what keeps me going. I'm right in the middle of the whole issue on how do you fix this broken immigration system? How do you maintain America as a nation of immigrants so it's lawful entry? So the numbers that we grant permanent residency is right. So we are able to grow our economy without depressing American wages. How do you fix a broken healthcare system? A broken healthcare financing system, primarily, because we still have fabulous medicine. That's why people get heart attacks around the world, or they've got a cancer, they come to America, because we still have a great healthcare system in terms of the doctors and nurses and technology. There's so many important things we have to deal with. And in the end, Steve, I love this country. There's never been a country like America. It is, as I refer to it, is something precious. And there were some real problem areas, and there's some real issues politically in terms of the left gravitating towards socialism. I mean, look at Venezuela. I'm engaged in this public debate trying to deter those that would actually look to Venezuela as a successful economic model and try to get them to embrace what our founders realized is a limited federal government primarily designed to protect our individual liberty and freedom in a free market system that is the best allocator of capital in the history of mankind, that has provided unbelievable prosperity to America. So, I enjoyed business, but what I'm doing now is just so much more important.
Two final questions. 20 feet away in this hallway, there is a group of Republicans that are asking delegates, and they asked me, and I couldn't, of course, sign a petition, you should run for governor in 2022. Are you considering that?
I am completely focused on the next 18 months, and that is the truth. I'll never say never. I have said that the reality changed from what I thought it would be. I really thought Republicans would be retaining the House as our firewall against socialism, against the Green New Deal, against some of these wacky ideas. If it's the Senate is the firewall, it might change my calculus. But trust me, I would like to serve the 12 years, have everything in a very stable situation, America on the right path, and then go home. That was my preference in 2016. It's my preference
12
today.
12 years and not 18, although you've just said you are passionately involved in the debate over who comes to America?
Precisely, yeah.
Okay. So you're still with a second term, final term in the Senate.
That is my intention. I mean, that was what I like to do. But again, realities change. You never say never.
I understand. Final question. Which Democrat of the 24 do you think would give President Trump the toughest campaign, sir?
My guess would probably be Vice President Biden.
Okay.
The Vice President, a very nice person, no doubt about it. I come from the private sector. You really can almost identify people. There's an engineer, there's a plant manager, there's an accountant, there's a sales manager. And Joe Biden is a sales manager. So, he could be pretty effective, but he's got a very long record, and he's got a very long record of supporting very wrong-headed policies, both in terms of foreign policy as well as domestic policy. So, when it comes, if you want to compare records, what this administration has done, reducing the regulatory burden, competitive tax system, business investment, the last 2 years, the Biden-Obama administration, business investment only grew at 0.6% over the last 2 years of that administration. We're over 6% in the first 9 quarters of this administration. That's laying in the economic foundation for future economic growth, as is the regulatory, deregulatory actions and a more competitive tax system. So I'm happy to put this administration's record up against what Biden did any day of the week.
U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, thanks for talking to Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Have a good convention.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir.